Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is November 19th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Machine Head, Non-Invasive Positive Pressure Ventilation in Out-of-Hospital Respiratory Distress. And I have two phenomenal guest skeptics today, Amy Panzenbeck and Kara Otterness. Please introduce yourself to the SGEM audience.
I'm Kara. I'm one of the emergency medicine chief residents here at NYU Bellevue. My academic interests include ultrasound, simulation, and resident education. When I'm not at work, I enjoy exploring new places, trying out new restaurants, seeing live music, and any and all outdoor activities.
Amy?
And I'm Amy. I'm also a PGY4 emergency medicine resident at NYU Bellevue. I'm a native New Yorker who spent 4 years in Boston for medical school, returning just before becoming a Sox fan, just in time. I like running, biking, and just started learning how to brew my own beer.
Oh, brewing your own beer. Homebrew, part of the foam movement. Way to work that into the podcast. Very nicely done, Amy. I can see why they picked you as the resident representation. Well, it's really great to have you guys here. So, Kara, I want you to tell me, what's the best part of the residency program at Bellevue?
Well, Ken, there's many great things about this residency program, but by far, the best part is the people. I feel honored and privileged to get to work alongside such an amazing group of residents and attendings. We do great work down in the ED every day, and we have a lot of fun doing it.
I think everybody just realized we are doing this live as a journal club here at Bellevue. Amy, you said you're from New York. How about telling me, as a non-New Yorker, what's the best part of being in the Big Apple?
Well, some people would probably say it's the arts or the culture. For me, it's probably the post-shift 2 a.m. food selection. Can't go wrong.
Nice. Nice. Is there anything either of you want to mention before we get started?
I think we covered it.
Okay. All right. Well, this is another SGEM Journal Club, and we're recording this in front of the NYU Bellevue residents. That's great. Can we have a New York whoop, whoop, whoop? Now, if the SGEM can make it here, yeah, it can make it anywhere. It's really exciting for me to be in New York. I had a great time last night going out to dinner with my wife, named Barb, yes, Ken and Barbie, and the Swami. So it was great to get out in the city and get some great food. I heard some wonderful stories about how excellent your residency program is, and so I went back to the hotel, and I did a little research, and I found out you have this guy named Dr. Jeff Menko. Dr. Menko said that you have the privilege of caring for a wide variety of patients, all from the different levels of the social strata, from diplomats and CEOs to those suffering from mental illness, substance abuse, and the homeless. Training in New York City, you get to meet and treat great people from all over the world. And if that wasn't exciting enough, you get to live in one of the most amazing, culturally diverse, and vibrant cities in the world. I have to tell you, ever since I got the invitation, I have been waiting to deliver this line. Live from New York, it's the SGEM! All right, well, why don't we get started with a case, and we like to start all of these podcasts to frame the conversation with a good case. And so, Kara, if you don't mind reading the case scenario that we put together.
So we have a 55-year-old male with a history of COPD, asthma, and CHF. He calls 911 complaining of some shortness of breath. So EMS arrives. They find a patient very short of breath. He's diaphoretic. He's only speaking in 1 to 2 word sentences. His respiratory rate is 40. Heart rate of 110. His oxygen saturation is 88% on room air, and he's afebrile. He's clearly working hard to breathe. The paramedics decide to use non-invasive positive pressure ventilation and routes to support this man's respiratory distress.
So, Amy, why don't you start with some background information about respiratory distress?
So, acute dyspnea is a common emergency department complaint. In 2003, this chief complaint comprised about 3.5% of over 115 million emergency department visits nationwide.
Well, I'm going to have to stop you there, Amy, and I know that this is a podcast, so people can't see this, but when you say million, can you put your pinky to your face and say 115 million? Yes, great. Okay, so Kara?
So a subset of these patients will present in respiratory distress, which is associated with increased morbidity and mortality. Often it can be hard to determine the exact etiology of the shortness of breath in a timely fashion, and therapeutic interventions need to begin before the exact diagnosis is known.
But luckily, the most common culprits of respiratory distress share a common treatment modality, and that treatment is non-invasive positive pressure ventilation.
So studies have shown that acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema, COPD, and asthma exacerbations all benefit from non-invasive positive pressure ventilation.
Yeah, Cochrane did a systematic review which included 32 studies and had almost 3,000 patients, and it looked at non-invasive positive pressure ventilation for cardiogenic pulmonary edema. And compared to standard medical therapy, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation significantly reduced hospital mortality, clearly a patient-oriented outcome. And the reduction was 0.66. This was a study done by Vital et al. Interesting, Vital et al. And we're talking about mortality. And it was done in 2013. I'll put a link in the show notes for you to review.
So I actually recently cared for a patient with history of CHF. He presented with acute onset of severe shortness of breath over the past couple of hours. He came in hypoxic. He had rails to his upper lung fields bilaterally. It was clear to us that this patient was in flash pulmonary edema.
Yeah, he sounds pretty sick.
Yeah, actually, he was very sick. He was sitting in the 60s on room air. So we started him on a nitroglycerin drip and BiPAP immediately when he arrived in the ED. But unfortunately, despite our quick actions, we were unable to pre-oxygenate him enough, even on the BiPAP prior to intubation. We did get him up to the upper 80s, but he just plateaued. And unfortunately, he suffered a hypoxic PEA arrest peri-intubation. We were unable to resuscitate him. And in retrospect, I wonder if he would have been more adequately pre-oxygenated had BiPAP been started in the pre-hospital setting.
Kara, that's a good question, but before we answer that question, what about the use of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation in hospital for COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases?
So there was an older Cochrane systematic review from 2004 by Ram et al. They looked at the non-invasive positive pressure ventilation for admitted patients with acute chronic obstructive pulmonary disease exacerbations. There are 14 studies in the systematic review with an N of 758. It also showed a decrease in mortality with a relative risk of 0.52, 95% confidence interval from 0.35 to 0.76.
So non-invasive positive pressure ventilation has also shown benefit in acute asthma exacerbations. There was another Cochrane systematic review by Lim et al., which identified six trials for inclusion, and their primary outcome was endotracheal intubation. And this is because it's pretty rare for asthmatics to die, and so there were no deaths in any of these studies.
There were only two studies in this systematic review that looked at their primary outcome, which was intubation. And these were small studies. They had a total of 86 patients only. And in those 86 patients, they only had two intubations. And with such small numbers, they could not find a difference between non-invasive positive pressure ventilations and standard care.
However, with limited data, they were able to show reduced hospitalizations, increased number of patients discharged from the emergency department, and improvement in some surrogate non-patient-oriented outcomes, such as respiratory rate and lung function measurements.
Speaking of asthmatics, I saw a bad case a few weeks ago. It was a 46-year-old woman with a history of asthma who had been intubated twice in the past, presenting in severe respiratory distress.
Amy, she must have been a bad asthmatic because we don't have to intubate these patients often.
She was. She reported worsening asthma symptoms over the past 2 days, particularly worse in the hour or two before she arrived. She was able to tell us that her symptoms were similar to prior exacerbations that had been severe. She had used her inhaler several times prior to coming in without much relief. She was brought in via EMS and received two nebulizer treatments, had an IV placed. In the ER, she appeared ill. She was tachycardic to 120, tachypneic to 32, and had an O2 sat of 87% with a normal blood pressure.
Wow, she does sound sick, just like Kara's pulmonary edema patient.
She was using accessory muscles, tripodding, unable to speak full sentences, so we threw the kitchen sink at her. She got continuous nebs, IV solumedrol, magnesium, epi, and started her on BiPAP, but just not improving.
Yep, Amy, that's kitchen sink for acute asthma care.
She was sleepy and tiring out despite the BiPAP, so we decided to intubate her. The intubation went smoothly. We had first pass success, but then about 30 minutes later, the high pressure alarm started to beep and the patient's O2 sat was dropping on the vent. We quickly went through the dope mnemonic.
Whoa, I'm going to have to stop you there. What's this dope mnemonic you're talking about?
I got this one, Amy. So the dope mnemonic... The dope mnemonic gives you a pathway to figure out why a patient is desaturating post-intubation. So the first thing you want to do is to disconnect the patient from the vents and start to bag while going through the dope mnemonic as follows. So D stands for displaced tube, and usually it's going to be displaced in the right main stem or the piriform fossa. So to detect displaced tube, you're going to look at the end-tidal CO2 waveform, and you're also going to listen for bilateral breath sounds. Next, the O stands for obstruction, and this could be anything from a kinked tube to the patient biting on the tube to a mucus plug. So you want to make sure you can pass a suction catheter all the way down. P stands for pneumothorax. So you want to listen for bilateral lung fields, and if the ultrasound's nearby, grab it and look for bilateral lung sliding. And lastly, E stands for equipment, and you actually want to do this first. You want to remove the patient from the vent and apply BVM, so this takes the ventilator equipment out of the picture and allows you to move forward.
Okay, thanks for giving us the dope on that. So it's displaced tube, obstruction, pneumothorax, and equipment.
So we disconnected her from the vent and went through the dope mnemonic, and found that the patient had a right-sided pneumothorax, requiring a needle decompression followed by a chest tube.
Good job, Kara. So how did the patient do?
The patient eventually went to the intensive care unit, but Ken, we were left wondering if BiPAP had been started earlier, whether all of this could have been avoided. Maybe instead of being on a ventilator with a chest tube in the ICU, we could have turned the patient around in the pre-hospital setting.
Okay, so I think we've really set the stage well. We know that there are lots of people out there who have respiratory problems like COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, congestive heart failure, and asthma. And we know that in hospital, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation improves patient-oriented outcome, like mortality. But what if we started non-invasive positive pressure ventilation in the field? So what's the specific question for today's podcast, Kara?
So the clinical question was, does out-of-hospital non-invasive positive pressure ventilation improve in-hospital mortality compared to standard treatment in patients with undifferentiated respiratory distress?
And Amy, what's the reference we're going to be using?
So we're looking at Mal et al., effect of out-of-hospital non-invasive positive pressure support ventilation in adult patients with severe respiratory distress, a systematic review and meta-analysis from the Annals of Emergency Medicine 2014.
Hey, did you guys know that this was from my university?
No, I
yeah,
didn't.
Yeah, no, it came from Western University. So this is a bit of a shout-out that they got published in Annals. So, hey, Mike Lewell, Adam Ducalo, and Shelley McLeod, good work. So let's go through the PICO, though. That's the population, intervention, and control. Okay, so what was the population they were dealing with?
So the population, they looked at 7 randomized control trials of adult patients for a total N of 632 patients. And these patients had out-of-hospital severe respiratory distress that was suspected to be of the etiologies including acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema, acute COPD exacerbation, and acute asthma exacerbation or pneumonia.
And Amy, what was the intervention that they were looking at?
It was the use of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation.
And Kara, they compared it to what?
Standard therapy.
All right, what was the primary outcome then?
The primary outcome was in-hospital mortality.
And did they have some secondary outcomes?
They did. Secondary outcomes included need for invasive ventilation, hospital and ICU length of stay, and complications from non-invasive ventilation.
So the author's conclusions from this study was, quote, out-of-hospital administration of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation appears to be an effective therapy for adult patients with severe respiratory distress, end of quote. Now, when we're using the critical appraisal tool and we're looking at randomized clinical trials included in a systematic review, we have 7 quality checklists. So I'm just going to alternate with the two of you and go through those checklists. The answers will either be, yes, you agree with them, you disagree with them, or we're not quite sure. So for the first question is, was the clinical question a sensible and answerable question?
Agree.
Question number 2, the search for studies, was it detailed and exhaustive?
Disagree.
And how about the primary studies, were they of high methodological quality?
Not sure.
And how about the assessments of studies, were they reproducible?
Agree.
And do you think that the study's outcome was clinically relevant?
Agree.
Question number 6, was there low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcome then?
Agree.
And the final, the 7th question for probing a systematic review is, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Agree.
All right, so those are the quality checklists we go through. How about giving us the key results? Kara, can you start with that?
Sure. So like we mentioned before, 7 studies were included in the analysis for a total N of 632 patients. 6 of the 7 studies used CPAP and 1 trial used BiPAP. The vast majority of patients, over 80%, were suspected to have acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema.
Yeah, that's right. The vast majority of patients did have acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema. It was over 500 of them. And that left 81 patients with acute exacerbations of COPD. And then you just get down to a handful of pneumonia patients, 19, and then only 10 patients with severe asthma. But you know what, Amy? What was that primary outcome they were looking for?
So the reduction of in-hospital mortality with the use of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation compared to standard care gave a risk ratio of 0.58 with a confidence interval of 0.35 to 0.95.
So that's confidence interval doesn't cross 1. So we know that that is significant. That decrease of 0.58 is significant.
So that gave a number needed to treat of 18.
So the reduction of in-hospital mortality was an NNT of 18. So you had to treat 18 people in the pre-hospital setting to prevent 1 death. How about the secondary outcomes?
So the need for invasive ventilation had a risk ratio of 0.37, also with a significant confidence interval of 0.24 to 0.58, and a number needed to treat of 8. ICU and hospital length of stay could not be pooled based on the studies. The complications were reported in 3 patients, and those complications were all emesis.
Okay, thank you. Those were the key results. Now let's provide some skeptical commentary. The patients with undifferentiated respiratory distress present to the emergency department quite regularly. As mentioned earlier, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation has been shown to be effective in reducing mortality in pulmonary edema and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease exacerbations. It is also shown to be helpful in asthmatics. So the authors ask a reasonable question on whether or not pre-hospital treatment with non-invasive positive pressure ventilation could also be a benefit.
The authors did an extensive literature search, including all the standard electronic databases. They also tried to identify any gray or unpublished literature. However, as with many studies, they did restrict their search to the English language studies.
It's hard to determine if the primary studies were of high methodological quality. From the data provided, they do appear to be reasonable, but there was insufficient information for a definitive answer.
5 of the studies were judged to be low risk of bias using the Cochrane collaboration tool for assessing risk of bias. Allocation was concealed in 5 of the studies. There was no blinding in any of them. It would have been pretty hard to blind patients or providers if they had a non-invasive positive pressure ventilation mask on their face.
Yeah, if you've got that big machine motorhead thing on your face, it's like, I don't know, am I in the control group or am I in the intervention group?
When it comes to follow-up, it was very good. We looked for less than 20% loss to follow-up, and in this study, only 8 out of 632 were not accounted for in the study.
So the primary outcome demonstrated significant patient-oriented benefit. There was decreased in-hospital mortality, and the number needed to treat was 18. So only 18 people needed non-invasive positive pressure ventilation to prevent 1 death. The secondary outcome of need for invasive ventilation was also very good, with a number needed to treat of 8.
We must be cautious when applying these results to our practice situation. 6 out of the 7 studies were done in Europe. Their pre-hospital system is much different than those in North America. They oftentimes have an emergency doc or an anesthesiologist in the ambulance. This difference could limit the external validity of these conclusions.
And another limitation would be the definition of standard therapy. What was standard therapy? They used a very broad definition in the manuscript. It included providing simple supplemental oxygen and nothing else, to using medications such as bronchodilators, nitroglycerin, calcium channel blockers, inotropes, morphine, and steroids. How does this standard therapy compare to your local therapy for patients in severe respiratory distress?
There were a variety of commercial, non-invasive, positive pressure ventilation products used in the different randomized control trials. Given the overall positive effects demonstrated, this would give strength to the conclusion that the intervention works. Additionally, there was no accepted standard dose for starting the therapy or the length of therapy.
Underreporting of harm is a well-known limitation of randomized control trials. It's unfortunate that only 5 of the studies commented on complications. 3 of the studies said there was no harm, while 2 studies reported that 3 patients in the non-invasive group experienced emesis.
Speaking of harm, traditionally we have been somewhat cautious in using non-invasive positive pressure ventilation for asthmatics for fear of barotrauma. Only 1 trial involving asthma patients with a total of 10 patients was included in this systematic review. In the small sample size, there were no report of complications.
So one of the things we like to do after we've looked at the literature, and we've looked at the key results, we've probed it for bias, and we've gone through some comments, is to compare our interpretation of it and compare it to the author's conclusions. So Kara, could you do that?
Sure. So the authors conclude that pre-hospital non-invasive positive pressure ventilation appears safe and beneficial for patients with respiratory distress. We add to this sweeping conclusion the caveat that non-invasive positive pressure ventilation is safe and beneficial in the appropriate clinical setting. And we have yet to clearly and overwhelmingly demonstrate the ability for all-comer EMS providers to recognize these appropriate clinical scenarios. Further studies with a broader inclusion criteria of truly undifferentiated dyspnea using a clearer spectrum of EMS providers may provide more clarity on this and help bring to light any unforeseen adverse events, which previous studies have not been powered to do.
All right, Amy, bring it home. Give us that bottom line. What's the take-home message?
Non-invasive positive pressure ventilation is a reasonable out-of-hospital treatment option for adult patients with grossly undifferentiated severe respiratory distress.
So the case resolution for what we put forward at the beginning of the podcast is the 55-year-old man with acute respiratory distress arrived with a non-invasive positive pressure ventilation already in progress from the pre-hospital setting. We predicted he would have been doing better on arrival. His respiratory rate is now normal. His heart rate is less than 100, and his oxygen saturation is 97%. You start working him up for the undifferentiated cause of what caused his decompensation, and you are optimistic that you will not need to intubate him. How about the clinical application from this? How will we take this information and apply it clinically, Kara?
As emergency medicine doctors, we like to think of ourselves as the front lines of medicine, but actually the pre-hospital providers are truly the first point of contact for the patients. They work in a more strained and sometimes hostile conditions, and they have fewer diagnostic tools at their disposal. And oftentimes, they are the difference in between our patients' good or bad outcomes. We should think of pre-hospital transport as an extension of our emergency department and our EMS providers as extensions of our staff. In this way, we should be arming EMS personnel with the best tools in order to deliver the most effective care and to do so as safely as possible.
Non-invasive positive pressure ventilation can and should have a huge role in pre-hospital care. Non-invasive ventilation would likely lead to fewer suboptimal in-field intubations, in addition to fewer patients arriving to the ED in extremis. We should be working with EMS coordinators to enable EMS providers to use non-invasive ventilation, implement clear protocols for appropriate use, and enhance physician EMS communication to make these decisions and manage potential complications.
And we always like to talk about what will we tell the patient? How will we make a shared decision? What would the language be we would use at the bedside? And in this case, it would be the paramedics. They would be talking to the patient. And a suggested way to express that they're about to put this large device on their face would be telling the patient, hey, we can tell you're in acute respiratory distress. You called 911 because you were really short of breath. We have this device that can help you breathe and help you breathe easier. It's been shown actually to save lives and may prevent you from having a large tube put down your throat. Now, the end of the podcast, the Keener contest. I guess you guys call it the Gunner contest. If you're like a really keen, enthusiastic person, we have this at the end of every podcast. It's a trivia question. And so last week's winner was Dylan Morris, an emergency medicine resident from Portland, Oregon. He knew that we avoid aspirin in febrile children because of the fear of Rye syndrome. Congratulations, Dylan. I will be mailing you a cool skeptical prize. Now I'm going to bring in the Swami, though, and I'm going to ask him to give the Keener contest for this week.
All right, Ken, here's the keener question for the week. What household device was commonly used in cardiac arrest to provide oxygenation and ventilation back in the 1500s?
Swami, that might be a little tough. Do you think you could give us a little hint?
All right, so we'll give a little bit of a hint. The device could be applied orally or rectally. They used to actually take smoke from a fire, and that could be administered rectally to help, I'm using air quotes, Ken, help in a cardiac arrest. It's really actually where the idea of blowing smoke up your ass came from, but I know Rob Orman knew that already.
Thanks, Swami, for that really interesting historic question. If you know the name of the device used to oxygenate or ventilate and blow smoke up your ass, then send me an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first person to correctly answer the question will receive a cool skeptical prize. We have a few conferences coming up that I want to mention. There's Ski Beam, January 26th to 28th in the Rocky Mountains of British Columbia. And then there's a Shock and Resuscitation Conference in Montreal, May 1st to 3rd. And then something we're all waiting for, the SMAC Chicago, June 23rd to 26th. Amy, Kara, thank you very much for doing the show.
Thanks for having us, Ken.
Thanks, Ken.
And thank you, Swami, for inviting me to the Big Apple to present social media and medical education the first 2,500 years.
Thanks, Ken.
And thank you to the NYU Bellevue EM program. Amy and Kara, as the guests, I'm going to ask you if you'll give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone.